Up next on Technometria, Scott and I talk with Kevin Henley. He's the author and editor of 97 Things Every Programmer Should Know, from IT Conversations. Kevin, welcome.
Welcome.
Yeah. And Scott, good to have you with us.
Yeah, it's good to be here on a nice rainy morning in California from the remote location.
Yeah, your remote studio. So, Kevin, nice of you to join us from England. It's a little late, getting a little late on in the day for you, but thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, Kevin, obviously the primary reason why I sent you a note and saw if we could get together was the book you recently had come out, 97 Things Every Programmer Should Know.
Yeah, it's published in February.
Yeah, now this is an O'Reilly book, and it's kind of an O'Reilly series, if you will. There's 97 Things Every Software Architect Should Know and a few others. Do you have any insight into where the 97 number came from? I was curious about that.
Yeah, the 97 number, it's probably the FAQ that I get. I actually put it up on a talk recently as FAQ and asked the crowd, what is the most commonly asked question? And indeed, it is, why 97? I can sort of get out of this one by saying that it's the series title. So it was given to me in that sense. But the way it was actually hatched was on a list, Bruce Eccles' Enterprise Programming list. There were a number of architects on that. It was a couple of years back, and discussion came up with Richard Monson Hafel that he was looking for a series of guidelines, something he could include in a conference talk that every architect should know. And he was looking for around 10, and the suggestions came sort of fairly thick and fast, and he realized he had an awful lot more in his hands than just one talk, and he published a few books with O'Reilly before. So he said, okay, well, why don't we explore this? And working backwards a little bit, and the way that I certainly rationalize it, particularly going into the 97 Things Every Programmer Should Know book, is you're looking for something that is going to be bite-sized, easy chunks people can sort of pick up very, very easily. So that tells you that in book form, you're looking at something like a two-page spread.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've taken in title, author, picture, and stuff like that, you're looking at around the 500 word mark or so. And two pages, 500 words, many different authors contributing individually. There's going to be changes in style, so it's not one continuous narrative. So you don't really want more than about 200 pages of this.
Yeah.
200 divided by 2 gives you about 100. So, and Richard said that 100 is too contrived. And 101 and 99 things, they're trying too hard not to be 100. So 97 is a compromise. It's around 100, but it's not trying too hard to be 100.
Nice. Yeah. So, speaking of that, there are, of course, in the book, 97. I didn't count them, but I presume that there's 97.
When I made the selection, I sat there with a spreadsheet just to make sure.
Yeah, but on the website, there's actually a wiki where there are the contributions that appear in the book, but there's also another list of, I can't remember, 60 or 70 or so that didn't make the book. I won't say didn't make the cut, because I looked at some of them. They're actually fairly good.
Yes, they are. It's not a quality ranking in that sense.
Yeah.
It was a tough decision, but yeah.
So I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the process of book creation, because that's not probably the most important thing to our listeners. But I am a little bit intrigued just by the curatorship that you put into this, because I think it does inform the book to some degree. You were the editor, and you got your contributions, and obviously you were contrasting them in some ways with 97 Things Every Software Architect Should Know, because that book already existed, right? So it had to be different than that. What kind of criteria did you use?
That's a very difficult one. What I was after was something that would speak directly to the programmer. One of the constraints on the 97 Things Every Software Architect Should Know was no graphics, no code, basically. It was very much a sort of higher-level view and very much in the bigger picture, if you like. What I was interested in is the fact I deal a lot with training and consultancy of certainly with architects, but also programmers. And it was a moment of frustration one day. I sensed that there was probably a gap for this book. Just one of those things. I remember thinking, you know, this is just one of those things every programmer should know. And so I was looking for something that would speak more directly to the programmer, not what the programmer wanted to be. Something that a sort of series of items that I think an experienced programmer would probably look at and just sort of nod comfortably and perhaps enjoy the read, or even better, pass on to mid-range to junior programmers, sort of say, you probably want to have a look at this. This is of interest. Or these are the words I was looking for when I tried to describe it to you. And perhaps the occasional insight, something that perhaps contradicts their experience, because there's enough variation if you pick a room full of programmers. No matter what their level of experience, you will find contradiction. I was after something that would serve this junior programmer and above, but also something for the senior programmer, somebody with experience that would possibly challenge them or offer them a different way of phrasing advice they probably already dished out. And that was, I think pretty much all the contributed items sort of fitted into that. There are only one or two that I sort of contacted the contributors to sort of say, well, this feels a little bit more like something for the architect book. But on the whole, I would have said that people pretty much got the message. This is what programmers should know. This is not necessarily just about programming. So it's a fairly broad range that was attracted.
Well, it's a great little book. You know, I hesitate to say this because I don't want it to come off poorly, but I mean, there's a book called The Great American Bathroom Book, which is like this collection of little stories, right, that you can read in the bathroom. And that's kind of what this reminds me of, because, you know, you could take this to the coffee shop, thumb through three or four of them, enjoy it, put it down, pick it up again a week later, you know, read a couple more. I mean, it's not demanding in the sense that it needs you to really go through it intellectually from front to back and make, you know, this huge mental effort to put it all together. I mean, it's just, like you say, these little bite-sized nuggets of wisdom, and I really like that about it.
Well, actually, the bathroom book sounds great, and that's actually kind of what I was after, though I probably wouldn't say that explicitly. I'd probably say talk about things like compilation and link cycles. But yes, it is exactly that. It's the idea you can pick it up. A lot of people commute into work or find themselves with a couple of minutes between tasks and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's very much that, and that backed up by the wiki itself is quite helpful. Well, I've noticed a couple of people actually use link bombing, sort of email their colleagues pointed hints about certain use of version control and so on.
Hey, this is my authority.
That's right. I found it was interesting. It was around the time I was actually doing some consultancy. It was around the time that I was making the final selection, and I was at a client site for a couple of weeks. And I found that doing a code review and also a design workshop with them, I referred to somewhere between 10 and 15 items just in passing. Fortunately, we had a machine hooked up in the meeting room, and I was able to just sort of give direct links to stuff. And that was very interesting, because that was the week that I was pulling everything together. So I was kind of noting down which are the ones that I seem to be referring to. And that was a interesting process in that sense. And so, yeah, because they're bite-sized, these guys could go away and come back. It's not as if I'd said, you know, go away and read this 500-page book that is the Bible on this topic. It's go away, read 500 words that will give you some insight and starting points for this topic, and perhaps a story to go with it, because there's a lot of the good contributions have got a little story to tell, personal experiences coming through, which I think is sort of something that you can only get from a wide range of contributors.
Yeah, and you know, some of them are kind of obvious. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, but you know, you read the title, and you read a title like "Don't Repeat Yourself," and you go, "Okay, I know what that means." And it's nice to read, because you know, it's nice to get, you know, in that case, it was Steve Smith's take on "Don't Repeat Yourself." But others of them kind of make you stop and go, huh? And you actually have to, you know, click through to figure out what does the author see that's important about this particular topic. Yes. Like read the humanities, for example. I mean, I kind of understand that, but why is that important for a programmer, right? I mean, that's so there's some of those in there that are real kind of nice hidden gems.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the things that I had a discussion with somebody a while back, and they said, well, you know, couldn't you write this book? And I said, I could write 97 things, but I don't think I could write the book, because, first of all, that's not the kind of book that I would write, but secondly, you wouldn't get that difference in style and opinion and insight from one person. Occasionally I get emails while the kind of call for contributions was out, I get emails from people asking me what guidelines do you have, you know, how should I write this? And I say, well, around 500 words. That's pretty much it.
They read like well-written blog entries, kind of.
Yes, and that was I don't think this is something that Richard was really thinking about when he pulled together 97 things every software architect should know, but it's something I was very consciously aware of, is that if you look at around the 500 word mark, you're looking at blog entry. So that certainly speaks to a certain attention span, but more from the point of view of the author of the piece. The author of the piece may not be an author. That may not be what they do for a living. If you look amongst the cross-section of people who've contributed, there are certainly some professional authors in there. But there's a lot of people who don't do that for a living, do not publish books. And there are a lot of people for whom English is not a first language. And if you start saying things like 1,000 or 1,500 words, there's a very large barrier to entry there, and a very strong disincentive, if you like, will filter people out. 500 words doesn't sound too challenging. And I said to a number of people who were a little concerned about the English, I said, don't worry, look, I'm the editor. I'll take care of the English. We will, you know, we'll bat this one to and fro, but 500 words is non-threatening.
Yeah, 500 words is a, you know, good email. That's
That's right. Yeah. That can encourage, it can bring somebody out of themselves, a little bit of informality. They'll find the story they want to tell, and they'll find that much more comfortable if you start saying higher word limits. It sounds very, very threatening.
So you mentioned that you could have written 97 things. You wouldn't have come up with these. And that leads me to wonder, do you have two or three in here that – I don't know what the right criterion is that surprised you, or maybe you learned something from, or you thought, wow, I would have never thought of that. That's a great idea. Or what do you, I don't want to ask you for your favorites, because I know that that's probably not a fair question, but what are two or three that you learned something from?
Oh, I probably learned something from all of them in one way or another, but I think the clarity. So you mentioned Don't Repeat Yourself by Steve Smith. I think there's a nice counterbalancing one. Beware the Share by Udi Dhahan, which is about potential dangers of trying to reuse and factor out and over-factor out things. And it's certainly something that I'm aware of and have, you know, cautioned other people about, of factoring out repetition by coincidence. Watch out for that. But Udi had a particularly good, strong personal tale to tell, where he had indeed taken a few lines of code. It was his first job out of college. He'd taken a few lines of code that he'd seen repeated in a couple of places and pulled them out into a library. And suddenly, this was not well received by his colleagues, and he was very surprised. And it was simply because he had now coupled together things that were effectively independent. These were four or five lines that were together coincidentally. And this, as I say, this is something that I've certainly cautioned other people on. But Udi had a very good way of putting it. It was very, very precise and very crisp, as well as backed by a sort of personal story. I think in terms of the other things that surprised me, or that I learned a lot from, was the focus that people put on things like deliberate practice and expertise and how to improve themselves. This is, I think probably a lot of programmers are aware of this, and they will probably say that it's important, but they will list it as a secondary concern or an assumption. You should do this, and it never gets stated. And there are a number of items there that kind of got me thinking, and you know, I've changed a couple of things that I've done just to try things out, just sort of points of practice and so on, from some of these. And I think most of these kind of listed, I had a set of categories, most of these are listed in things like learning skills and expertise section. And there's a lot of really good insight into things you may already have done, but not for those reasons. And again, I wouldn't say that there's just one thing in there. Read the Humanities, is as you mentioned before, is quite a good example. But there's also stuff like the Guru Myth, which I thought was a rather good little piece. by Ryan Brush, mm-hmm. And Oliver Mowdell's Hard Work Does Not Pay Off. These are all very they're slightly the softer side, but again, they cause you to reflect, because they talk about, well, you know, your own personal aspirations, but also how are you going to spend the hours of your day and the days of your week? So there's some really, really interesting ones there. I think the other one that surprised me is the number that have an undercurrent emphasizing use of command line tools, mm-hmm. which I thought was interesting, and certainly fits a personal bias, but it was interesting to see that shared by other people.
Yeah, without soliciting it specifically. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing, is this was very much a sort of crowdsourced view. What do others think? I mean, there's people there that I know and have initially contacted, but there's a load of people that I don't know, and they've found out about the book and contributed stuff, and they've sort of contributed stuff that fits right in without any problem there.
It's funny, as I looked at it, I thought there were a couple that are interesting. Even, you know, it's almost, you know, common sense, and then you realize it's not common sense when you have things like putting things in version control. And then even within that one, I like that you know, or it touches on sort of some of even the differences of opinion about using version control. Is it large commits of lots of changes, or small and frequent commits of small changes and things like that? Or even the other one that I thought was clever is, you know, the know your IDE. I mean, just
yes.
Really looking at, you know, learning to exploit the tools and the things that you have.
Yeah, and I think that the fact that these are made explicit, these are often things that are assumed. But again, the put everything under version control item is interesting, because first of all, it's not just use version control, it's put everything under version control. And that's a sort of a provocation. It's not just your source code. It's not just your tests, and it's not just bits and pieces about your environment. It really is everything. If you consider anything on your project an asset, put it under version control. If disk space is a problem, then worry about that one when you hit it, because that used to be the concern people had. And programmers who've been around for a long time don't do a lot of these things, partly because they learnt their habits in a very different environment these days. It used to be a case of, well, we can't version control that because we will run out of hard drive. And there is a server rather than a cloud of servers sitting out there somewhere. And Diamodus in that one is very, very explicit about what and why. So that's what I like about a lot of the stuff that is seemingly obvious advice. It's backed up by something that's got a little bit more depth. Either it's a story or some explicit points or some edges, if you like, that normally get ignored.
Yeah, I think one of the things I liked a lot about the book was that almost all of them have some story behind them, which is, you know, it just makes it so interesting to read, because it's not just a list of do's and don'ts. There's a story there, and you go, oh, wow, I can see how that would happen. So the one thing I thought as I was looking through this, I ran into this one, this is just an example, Code Layout Matters by Steve Freeman. And, you know, it is an example of the story. He talks about how he used to work in some COBOL that you couldn't change the format because people that haven't coded for a long, long time like me probably won't remember, but there used to be special columns, right?
Yeah.
And you put something in a special column and the code would break. And he talks about that. And so they had this really ugly COBOL, and then he makes an observation, which I think is interesting, because while I kind of know this, I hadn't ever specifically thought about it, that we spend a lot more time navigating code than we do typing new stuff, right? Just reading and navigating. And so you need to optimize for that and make sure that people can do that. And I think that there's a kind of a thread there that goes into some of the IDE and other comments that people make about, you know, why do you have the tools that you have?
Yes, I think that is very important. A lot of these things are making explicit things that people either didn't know or knew or acquired at some point in the past, or perhaps didn't think about from another point of view. And the one you point out in Steve's article is this idea of optimizing for the human being and for the task in hand, as opposed to, often people are told, you know, code layout, it matters because it's pretty, it's It makes it look good. It makes it look appealing or whatever. It's more comfortable to read. But actually, there's something more. There's something more basic. And one of the points he makes sort of says, you know, properties that we're interested in terms of optimization is easy to scan. We're good at pattern matching. And I think he mentions a leftover trait from the time we had to spot lions on the savannah. You know, very much. Yeah. You know, tying that into. There is a human being on this side of the keyboard, and it's a point that's taken up in one of the other items where the observation is made that, okay, so screen sizes have changed an awful lot since the 1960s, but the human being's still biologically the same. There hasn't been much change. And that's Yahil Kimki's Coding with Reason. It's these observations of we're pretty smart at a number of things, but most things are learnt, and then we are physically constrained. So there's a few items that touch on this kind of cognitive ability or disability that we have in certain cases.
Kevin, it strikes me, you know, I've been a college professor now for 20 years off and on. I keep quitting to start companies, but I eventually always go back to teaching. And one of the things that I was thinking about as I was going through this book is when we teach people to program, we generally think about the structural aspects, which are clearly important. I mean, most students don't come at this with even an idea of, oh, you could loop or you could make a choice or those kinds of things. So clearly we have to teach them that. But it seems like much of the knowledge or wisdom that's in this book, we kind of leave for people to pick up as they go along. You know, they make a mistake or they talk to a friend or they get on the job or whatever. And I think that's really an important contribution this book makes is pulling together at least 97 things that every programmer ought to know. There's probably hundreds more.
Yes, I mean, that's definitely the case, and it's certainly the reason it's not called the 97 things every programmer should know. But it is a good cross section of, as it were, on the job wisdom. It's the stuff that, as you say, we look at the structural aspect, we look at the bricks, but we don't often look at the mortar, and that's actually quite difficult to teach. I mean, where and how would you explicitly choose to teach somebody how to use a bug tracker, for example? That's one of the items. And you wouldn't, I mean, I'm not talking the mechanics of pushing buttons. I'm talking about offering somebody meaningful feedback that they can use to fix a bug, you know, how to recreate the bug, what information is useful. If you simply say, you know, this sucks or something like that, that all that tells somebody is that you are angry at the time, and that was it. There's no wisdom there. It's the idea of this reflection. What's it like to be on the other end of that relationship? What would you like in a bug report? Have you ever thought about bug reporting as a skill, for example? Have you ever thought about debugging as a skill? Often, again, these are not things that are necessarily taught. People are taught for the best case, and there's a very strong emphasis on the software as an entity in its own right. Where do the skills about how to structure a build come from? These are often sort of left either unspoken or people stumble across them, and sometimes they end up with very ad hoc approaches to these things because they don't have a sort of a shared conversation. They don't recognize it's actually a skill to be had. I think that a lot of the stuff that I found people were contributing was this stuff that filled the spaces and was very much based on skill, reflection, and very strong emphasis on reflection. And I think that is also the value for the more senior developer in looking at some of these. A more junior developer will probably learn something directly. A more senior developer has been given the opportunity, just by reading one of these two pages, to read somebody else's view on something, a moment to sort of pause, almost look in the mirror and reflect on something that they may or may not already know, but it probably hasn't been said or reasoned about it. They haven't said it that way or reasoned about it that way. They probably even haven't thought of it as an explicit piece of knowledge to have and improve. And I think that's the thing, by pulling a lot of these out. And I noticed this very much when I was drawing up the categories for the book. I mean, this is very much an after-the-fact exercise. I didn't create categories in advance. I went through and looked for sort of categories, almost tags, if you like, that would be associated with each item. And you get the usual kind of coding guidelines and code layout stuff. But there's a lot of emphasis on build and deployment. There's a lot of emphasis on skills and expertise and professionalism, if you like, mindset, attitude, all of these, plus the usual things like programming languages and concepts like reuse, and then some of these other softer skills, the stuff that is also very difficult to teach, dealing with schedules, deadlines, estimates, this kind of stuff. And a lot of practical knowledge, again, backed by sort of personal stories in many cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like I said earlier, I love the stories. They really make a big difference in this. I think you bring up the categories that you put things in, and it's interesting to look through there because when you look at the categories, you see, some things have a couple, two or three. Five maybe is like the least, right, in each category. Some of them obviously have a lot more things like refactoring and design principles. A lot of people have to say a lot about. You mentioned the build and deployment category, which I think is interesting. I just was speaking to a class I teach about build and deploy and said exactly one of the things that's here, deploy early and often. And, you know, that's one of the things that beginning programmers don't have almost any experience in, because most of the time build meant push the button in the IDE and that was it, right? There was not much more to it than that. One of the things that I saw a couple of times, in particular, I think it was item 11, code in the language of the domain, and then 65, preferred domain-specific types, was about how you should bring the problem domain into the program, essentially, that when the problem domain shows up in the code in reasonable ways, it makes the code a lot more easy to read and understand what problem is being solved.
Yes, I think that is. I think that's one of those. It's almost too obvious to state, except for the fact that wherever I go and I do code reviews, or even if I'm just running a training course, I am surprised at the amount of domain that is left out of the code. Mm-hmm. And this is something that needs to be emphasized. And what I like about a couple of these examples is the code in the language of your domain by Dan North, for example. He uses a very concrete example that looks, a lot of people would sort of say, oh, it's an if statement with some kind of lookup and a map of maps type of thing. And they would pass that off as acceptable because maybe they've written that, more likely they've seen it. And there's that kind of familiarity. It's I've seen it lots, therefore it must be okay, or that's expected. And just a very simple idea of rearranging that and say, well, what does this actually say? It's unlikely that when we're dealing with the domain of traders and portfolios, that we're actually talking about maps of maps. These guys don't talk about that. They talk about portfolios. And the question is, when dealing with insider trading, are you allowed to look at certain portfolios? Now, I want to see that as a business rule leaping out of the if statement. I don't want to be lost in the underlying abstractions. There's a whole notion of layering and using that language very, very explicitly. You find this with a lot of code that people will nod quite happily and say, oh, I can create a class. And then you go and look at their code, and it's ints and strings. There are integers and strings absolutely everywhere, and then a few collection types dotted around. And you know, collection is called collection or something like that. And you're missing. You have this sort of sense of being in a foreign land almost. You know, you think, well, I know what kind of system this is. This is a system to sell books, but I don't see books here. Where are the books? I see if statements and fundamental types and a lot of pushing around of each of these things. There's a lot of traffic in these primitives, but there's nothing really speaking to me. And this idea that it's coupled with the number of other items that are on code care, if you like, that the idea is the code is a description of what you know. It's capturing your knowledge, so therefore you ought to care about it. And it is in some ways a first-class citizen, even though it's never seen as software from the outside. A user will never perceive these ideas. But the idea is you are writing a description of what you know. Now, how good is that description? How clear is that to yourself and to others? And that leads into some, again, that bridges into a number of these other reflective items. Kariana Berg did one on read code, just a very simple idea, read code. Not just the code that you may be maintaining, but read somebody else's code, just as we see in other professions. I mean, it's certainly true, very, very true in architecture and art, that one of the things you have to do is study existing designs, existing pieces of art. We see it in the sciences. I mean, people are taught and retaught certain models of the solar system and the atom again and again to get a sense of this other source of knowledge, to learn how it was done, that there are these kind of principles there. It's right across all these disciplines of knowledge. And what you find in a number of these cases is a lot of people don't actually read code as an activity. They read code when they have to. They read code when they have to maintain it. They read code when they have to touch it. And that's their only point. And they're probably not in that space of learning. You know, yeah. I'm not going to say this is all poetry, but it's a case of like, I'm going to just read this code to see how this other person has done it.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought, because I actually, maybe I'm incorrect in this, but I actually think that programming is very similar to the work that mathematicians do, in the sense that both disciplines are about notations. And I used to do quite a bit of work in formal proof, and it's I think that most people who work in math would kind of find it funny to think that you wouldn't read other proofs, right? Right.
Yes.
That the part of the job is reading other people's stuff, but because our code is, we think of it primarily as about communicating behavior to the machine, expected behavior to the machine. We don't necessarily think of it as this way of communicating knowledge to other people, but in fact, you know, that's the famous Donald Knuth, you know, literate coding, literate programming idea. And we probably don't do enough of it. We probably don't expect students to do enough of it. And as professionals, I'm sure we don't. I know I don't do enough of it.
Yeah, I think that is very a very important idea. And going back to, I mean, I was picking on physics rather than maths because originally I did that. But it's a case of with maths, you go through the same simple proofs that were done in the past. And you know, one person can say, "Well, haven't we already done this?" Well, yes, but how are you going to learn how to do the next thing? How do you learn what good code is? And it turns out that although we're able to often articulate principles, these principles are without. They sound great. They're often good sound bites. They offer good guidance, but they can be like the sound of one hand clapping, that you're missing something else. Unless you have actually been exposed to lots of code and you've read around, then you won't be able to fit those principles around anything. They'll be just sitting in a vacuum, and then you'll sit down to code and they're disconnected from your activity. If you can't connect them to that idea of having seen this, oh yes, I saw the way that this guy expressed that, or it's a very elegant decomposition of a class, or a particularly good choice of library that this guy used, and it simplified the problem, or it made something expressive. And this idea of reading as a more active thing rather than an accidental thing. I've instructed the machine and that's it. But I think also, and I think this again ties into both the idea of disciplines such as poetry and maths, there's the idea of thinking of your code not just as communicating to the machine or even communicating to a colleague or yourself say in 6 months' time, but also framing your thoughts. And again, it comes back to the a number of the items that are focused on capturing the domain and clarifying the requirements. The idea of, do I really understand this? When I'm writing a piece of code, am I struggling to name things? Or am I struggling with the idea because it's actually technically hard? Or have I not understood this problem? This idea that you're actually trying to frame your own thinking in a formal notation, which has rules and symbols and all the rest of it. And this idea, I think, comes out as a sort of secondary or theme in a number of the items. That, and I think it's interesting that many of these contributors who've never met each other have followed or arrived at a similar conclusion. They followed the same lines to get there, and this idea of that the code is more than just a bunch of ASCII or Unicode. There's a little bit more to it than that, and it's not even just about just communicating with their colleagues. There's an act of thinking and reflection, the ability to be able to write something well. It probably shows you've understood it, and that there's that sort of achievement. You can feel comfortable and proud of that, and that again takes us into the kind of the strong emphasis on professionalism that a lot of the articles have.
Yeah, there is a great emphasis on professionalism, and I like that because I don't necessarily know that we emphasize that enough. The idea of reading code gets us into, or at least in my mind, some of the other topics that seem to come up around programming languages. You know, there was the one, I'm trying to find it here in the list, by Russell Winder about know well more than two programming languages, right? The idea that that your programming ability will be enhanced by knowing more programming languages than just the ones that you happen to be working in right now. And the other one by Klaus Marquardt. Did I say that right?
Marquardt, yeah.
Russell Winder, learn foreign languages, meaning, you know, if you're a C++ or a Java programmer, go learn Haskell, for example, which is, you know, a completely different paradigm.
Yeah, I think that this is something that is, again, it's we're kind of going through at the moment a sort of Cambrian explosion of languages. There's a sort of a boom bust cycle, sort of in each decade. You can kind of find this, and for some people, there's a sort of natural hobby and pursuit of other languages. But something I've had as a sort of long held belief, even given that languages are quite interesting in their own right, is this idea of being able to see your own main language from another point of view, and being able to get a clearer understanding of it. There's this idea of having a second language giving you a second soul. This is a Charlemagne quote, and this idea that, in fact, I was talking to somebody about it just today. This idea, we were talking about our programming past, and my first commercial job was programming Fortran, and then I programmed C, and you know, lo and behold, my C looks like C spoken with a very strong Fortran accent. But then I started looking at some functional programming stuff. I started looking at there was a language around called Gopher many years ago, and Lisp.
Yeah,
and
I've used Gopher.
Yeah, and so that, and I suddenly found, I mean, this was just on the side of a personal interest, I suddenly found that my C was crisper. It was more clearly thought out. I moved away from sort of a more 1960s Fortran, a 1960s, 1970s Fortran style into something that was a little more fluent, a little more clear, more composable, easier to reason about. And it still looked like C. It was syntactically C. It was probably closer to copies still attempts, but it still had something else, and I'd learned from that. A talk I gave many years ago on to a conference, the early days of Java, I took in some ideas from Smalltalk that I'd found had influenced me in terms of thinking, and a couple from C++, and saw how actually using those in the context of Java gave you a different idea about how to work with the language constructs. And so this idea, again, even if you're looking at languages that aren't your main job's language, you will probably learn something else. You'll get a different perspective. You'll learn why an idea that you apply is a good idea. You know, sometimes people often say, well, I do this because I do this because I've always done it. When you see it from the outside, you may say, I'm solving this problem in this language. It's to do with resource management, which is automated in that language, but I'm now in a different context. Now I understand why I do that. Or performance matters in this case, but I couldn't see the performance before. This language makes it more obvious to me, or it makes it easier to make the right choice. So now I can go back to my other language and be aware of some of the subtleties that I may run into elsewhere. It's all these little bits and pieces. Now, I think that's a very, as you point out, that it's a fairly common theme amongst many of the programming language focused items in the book. This idea of just getting this external perspective, even if you're never going to use the other language. And of course, you may use that other language. That's part of, that may be the next step in your career. You may find you've set yourself up very nicely. But I think, again, there's a broader appreciation of language. And sometimes people have this view that, you know, my main language is, I think it was in the index this week, C came out number one again, and Java's dropped to number two. So maybe my main language is C, but that doesn't mean that I cannot learn about better data abstraction by working with Java. But at the same time, if I am working with C, there's a very high chance I'm not just working with C. I'm working with build scripts. I'm going to be working with shell scripts. All of these are languages in their own right, and a couple of the other items make this very clear, particularly the ones about build, that people have a very strange relationship. They say, well, my main language is C, or my main language is Java. And then my build file, well, that's a make file, and it looks like a dog's dinner, but it's not really a language. So therefore, I don't treat it with the same reverence and respect that I do my C code. I don't lavish the same care on it. I don't even bother learning the details.
Yeah, I've ran into projects where the build files weren't in. They took great care to put all of the major projects or the major code files into the version repository, but didn't have the build scripts there.
Yeah, they don't get the same respect. And we have, again, a couple of the items here put everything under version control and one binary and so on. This idea that all of this stuff is part of the project and has the same respect. Yes, you may... You may like cutting Java in this IDE, and that may be what you think of yourself as doing, but all of these other things are exactly the same. And we get this, if somebody's playing around with Ant, and then you look at the XML for that, in many cases, this is just incomprehensible. People say, I've got really clean Java, and you go and look at the build script, and it's just this nightmare. I know a couple of software architects who actually say that that's their measure of the project. They don't want to look at the code first. They want to look at the build script, and that will tell them more about the project than looking at the code, which I think is, again, a very interesting view. That tells them about the structure and also the care that people take over how stuff fits together. So this idea of raising other languages, not just the obvious candidates to a more first-class citizenship, is something that comes through, I think, in a lot of these items. And that's something that maybe people don't think. And again, this is one of those areas where the book will just sort of prod them or remind them or offer that opportunity for reflection.
Yeah, that and obviously a discussion of languages brings us to one of my favorite topics, which was the contribution from Michael Hunger, which is domain-specific languages, which is really just taking that whole idea to the next level and saying, well, we should not just build some abstractions in the core language, but let's build a whole, let's think very carefully about the entire abstraction of what we want somebody to do and build our own notation for it.
I mean, getting back to the point about mathematics, and I think it was Richard Feynman that said many years ago, he said, progress in mathematics has been, through the centuries, has largely been about the invention of notation to express some idea that was either previously inexpressible or very clumsy to express. And we see very much the same with programming languages and their flexibility. And this idea of domain-specific languages has a very, it's become very current in the last couple of years, but it's got a very long history and the Unix little languages and so on. The idea of, we have a problem that looks like this, and yet the it doesn't look like a C-shaped problem. What is it going to look like? And the notational idea, Joe Armstrong, the inventor of the Erlang language, I remember he once mentioned to me, said, people keep telling me that concurrent programming is hard. And I asked them whether they've composed a command line, a Unix command line involving a pipe. And often people say yes. And he said, well, look, you just wrote a concurrent program and there was no hassle. There was no challenge. You weren't thinking mutexes and so on. You were just using the wrong notation or the wrong model. And here we have the ability to compose this. And again, the Unix command line and the ability to compose pipelines is something that pops up in a number of the two or three of the items here. But this idea of being able to find a notation that aligns most conveniently with what you're trying to say rather than necessarily trying to brute force it through a general purpose programming language, which, has, whilst they have their virtues, they are general. They're not specific. And normally people have specific problems rather than general ones. So, I was very glad that I was a bit concerned that I wasn't going to get anything on DSLs because I thought it needed to be in there as something that people should be more aware of partly because it's current, but also because it's an idea that never goes away, and it helps describe the invention of things like regular expressions and many of the little languages like Orc and so on from a historical point of view, but also considering things like build files as actually having their own language, whether it's make or rake or ant. There is an idea there that there is a tool with a language to talk about your builds. That's all it talks about. It has no pretension to be a UI description language or a high performance computing language. It's just there to talk about your builds. So it's going to try and align as comfortably as possible with that.
Yeah. So as we get towards the end here, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was your own contributions, because you made a couple of contributions to this, and two of them were specifically about testing.
Yes. Yeah, as a general observation, I was very interested by the number of testing contributions we had. It was very, very high. But I found the three that I included, one of them was on commenting, and there are a couple, two or three items on commenting and the rationale and so on for how you do and don't comment, but also for the testing aspect was the content, if you like, of what goes into a test case. I mean, the two were test for required behavior, not incidental behavior, and test precisely and concretely. There's a sort of an interesting balance here that I see when people are writing their tests, that sometimes people will end up testing, you know, let's just say that a method is stated to return a negative number. That's it. You know, in a particular situation, it'll return you either 0 to some n that's an index, or it'll return a negative number. And -1 is as good a negative number as n, as you'll ever find. And people will find in their tests that they've gone and hard-coded -1. So they've now actually taken an incidental detail and turned it into something very, very specific. And you find that also with spacing. Another common one I found many years ago reviewing some tests, people were dealing with testing code that was generated from something. And they were testing the number of spaces. Well, they didn't mean to, but they sort of tested space, if, space, open parenthesis. And the point is that if you stripped all the space out of that, or you chose a different indentation, then all of a sudden every single test case you had would fail, even though the semantics were exactly the same. And people accidentally find themselves sort of taking the answer that's given and then slapping it back into the test case and creating their tests. Although they're thinking that they're getting good coverage, what they're actually doing is they're preventing themselves from doing change of any kind at all. And I saw an example last year that was very dependent on the ordering within a hash table. And I don't think the author realized it. All it takes is one small change, add another item, or a different version of the hash to be released, and all of a sudden you have a test that breaks. So there's that notion of looking for required behavior, not the incidental stuff. Don't test that the code does what the code does. Test that it does what it's supposed to, and it satisfies, you know, you take a requirements-based view rather than implementation view. But then at the same time, there's this balance, testing precisely and concretely. I run training courses, and I'm very interested when I use simple examples like collection-based examples. You know, start off, a collection is empty, for example. So we'll assert that it's empty in its initial state. And then you put one item into it. And the number of people that sort of say, well, that would be, you know, not empty. Well, that's a good start. What would its size be? Well, what would the size of the original one be? It would be 0. So what's the size of the new one? Well, not 0. Well, there are 4 billion not 0 values. Only one of them is correct. Yeah. So when the answer is supposed to be 1, then it should be 1. And it's as simple as that. And this is the idea that that we do often test in very, very vague ways, that the result of this is not null. Well, it's not just not null. It's got a specific, when we look at the object at the other end, it's got specific properties. It's not just that it's not null. There's a little bit more to it than that. So we end up with these kind of vague things. I use the example in that one that I'm very fond of using, and it catches a lot of people out. And I remember it caught me out when I was first presented it on a formal methods session that I attended. Of just a simple sorting algorithm. And most people have in their head that the idea is that take a sequence of numbers and sort it. What would you assert is the result? And people will always say, assert that it is sorted. And that's it. And I said, well, wait a minute. What about the conservation of values? That's surely quite important. There are billions upon billions of sequences that are sorted and they're not the right one. So I think what's interesting, and I mentioned that briefly, is that this actually did occur at a particular company where they had to tune a sorting algorithm for a set-top box. And fortunately, it didn't get to production, but they got it wrong. Very simply, they ended up with a very elaborate scheme for copying the first element of an array over all the other elements, which means it is indeed sorted in non-descending order. But it's not the right answer.
But it wasn't the original item sorted. Yeah,
loss of conservation values, and so it was. Is that that emphasis, which I think when we look at all the other items on testing in the book, it gives a very good spread to a number of items focus on testability. Others focus on the role of system testers. The others focus on why unit testing makes sense. And then there's a couple that actually focus on the mechanics of how to do this. And so mine sort of sit in that space.
I think we could probably sit here and talk about each of the contributions that you received from various people. That every one of them is interesting and has good stuff. Very, very interesting book, and I think it's going to be a great contribution to what programmers can do.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on, Kevlin, and thanks for the book. I appreciate it very much. You've been listening to Technometria. For more of Technometria, please visit my weblog at www.windley.com.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Paul Figiani. Our website editor was Joel Cherney. The series producer is Joel Cherney.
My name is Phil Windley, and I hope you join me next time for another edition of Technometria on IT Conversations.